Chapter 9. The morning drizzle was scarcely yet lightening in the east, but the nearby candle factory had already started pouring out its nauseating smell, and a damp group of wives, children, friends and servants had already gathered outside the gates of the Marshalsea. A few minutes before the time for opening, Sophie Aubrey came walking through the mud, high-perched on pattens. "Why, Stephen," she cried, "here you are at last. What a pleasure to see you. But how early you are. And how wet," she added, looking at him with large, startled eyes. "Put your hat on at once. You mustn't get your head wet too, for heaven's sake. Come and shelter under my umbrella. Hold my arm."
"I particularly wish to catch you before you went in to see Jack," said Stephen, "but in my hurry I mistook the hour. I've never been very clever at telling what's o'clock."
The gates swung inwards with their usual shriek, and the people walked in, treading their habitual paths. But the debtor's side was open half an hour before the rest, and Stephen led Sophie to the coffee-house, where they sat in a deserted corner.
"You look quite tired out as well as wet. Give me your greatcoat, Stephen."
She hung it on the back of a settle to drip. She said, "I'm afraid you haven't heard any good news, my dear." But without waiting for an answer, she called for coffee, hot and very strong, if you please, Mrs. Goadby, some rolls and 2 soft-boiled eggs for the gentleman.
"Should I have been travelling with barely a pause at all, I had hoped that hard labour would somehow earn an encouraging word, and indeed one great man did hint that the imprisonment might be remitted. But all the rest is black. Lawrence explains to me that a new trial is impossible, since all the so-called conspirators were included in the indictment and all were found guilty. They must all present themselves to make an appeal. It must be the whole body or nothing. It's a new rule of the court."
"How I hate lawyers," cried Sophie, her eyes growing dark. "So much for the appeal. And as for the sentence, time and again I was told by the men and women to whom I applied that they could not alter the course of justice."
"Justice be damned," said Sophie in the very tone of her cousin Diana. And although, to be sure, that was exactly what I wanted them to do, I was even more concerned with altering the course of custom. I mean, in preventing Jack's name from being struck off the list. If he's guilty, or rather if he's found guilty of an infamous crime, an officer's name is automatically struck off. It's not a matter of law, but of custom. And it has such a force that, as Prince William assured me, speaking most earnestly and with tears in his eyes, neither he nor the First Lord could change it. Only the King, or in this case the Regent, has the power. He's in Scotland, and in any event I'm known to him only as his brother's friend. And he and his brother are on very bad terms at present. So I travelled down to Brighton and waited upon his wife."
"His wife, Stephen?"
"She is usually known as Mrs. Fitzherbert."
"Are they indeed married? I thought she was a Roman Catholic."
"Certainly they're married. The Pope himself wrote to tell her the ceremony was valid and that she was his canonical wife. Charles Weld showed me the document. I knew him well, cousin to her first husband and at one time a priest in Spain. She received me very kindly. But she shook her head, saying she had almost no influence now, and even if she had, she doubted anything could be done. However, she did advise me to see Lady Hartford, and that's what I intend to do. But listen, Sophie, this appeal to the Regent cannot be made quickly, I find, if indeed it can usefully be made at all. In the meanwhile, the surprise has been bought. She is to be a private ship of war, and she now lies at Shelmerston with Tom Pullings in charge. He sends word that prime seamen by the score, many of them old shipmates, wish to embark if Jack commands her. If he'll consent to do so, we can get away the moment all this is over. Above all, if there is to be no imprisonment. You must make him consent, my dear."
"But why do you not ask him, Stephen?
Why have you not told him all this?"
"Why," said he, looking down at his eggs,
"in the first place, there's been no time. I've been away. And then again, there is a certain awkwardness, do you see? The role of Deus ex machina is not one that I care for at all. You would do it far better. If he raises the point, you will say that there is no obligation in the world. The one supplies the capital, the other the skill. I couldn't sail a ship across a horse pond, nor attack a simple rowing boat. And I should certainly never sail with any other captain. Pray tell him I hope to look in this evening to hear his good word. I must be away. God bless now. Remember, you must not say privateer or corsair. You must say letter of marque, or private man-of-war. As Stephen approached Sir Joseph's door in Shepherd Market, he saw Colonel Warren come out, step into a chariot that bowed under his weight, and drive off. He knew that Warren was the Horse Guards' new representative on the committee, an unusually active, stirring, sharp-witted man. But he didn't wish to be known to him, and he walked on for a few minutes. When he made his call, he found his friend looking extremely grave. "At this rate," said Sir Joseph, "I shall be suspecting Lord Liverpool and half the Cabinet of high treason. There are some utterly inexplicable contradictions. Perhaps Cerberus himself has run mad. How I wish this business were half as easily resolved as yours." He opened a drawer and said, "Here are your letters of marque against France, Holland, the Italian and Ligurian Republics, the United States of America, vessels bearing the flag of Papenburg, and half a dozen others. I've had them ready for you since Wednesday." "God set a flower on your head, dear Blaine," said Stephen. "I am exceedingly grateful, and I should have looked in on Wednesday itself, so I should, but it was 2 in the morning when I passed through London on my way to a town called Bury. I've been going to see every important man or woman in the kingdom who has the least kindness for me." "If you were travelling in Aubrey's favour, and I make no doubt you were, you might have saved your coach hire. You can no longer bribe judges in this country, nor cause them to be bribed, nor persuaded, still less commanded. There is only one single exception, as I could have told you before you set out, and that is where the judge happens also to be a member of the cabinet, which is the case with Lord Quinborough. He is by definition responsive to the political wishes of his colleagues. Now, your name has already been put forward as the ideal man for this entirely unofficial contact with Chile and possibly Peru, to which administration attaches very great importance. It was represented that you were bilingual in Spanish, a tried and tested intelligence agent in the ideal vessel with the ideal excuse for his presence in those waters, and that you would be a Catholic dealing with other Catholics, many of them Irish or half-Irish themselves, the younger O'Higgins, for example. These qualifications, together with that of a very large private fortune, were conclusive. The restricted gathering was delighted and rubbed its collective hands. But a gentleman then observed that although you possessed all the virtues, you certainly wouldn't sail unless the ship was commanded by Aubrey. So, since the matter presses, I believe you may rest easy about the imprisonment." Sir Joseph looked at the clerk and said, "If you mean to be there for his appearance in court, you must hurry." "I do not," said Stephen. "It seems to me that onlookers are strangely out of place. But I have taken the liberty of desiring a message to be sent to me here." "Excellent," said Sir Joseph. "But I'm afraid the sentence will shock you. Quinborough may not imprison, but he will jet out his venom in some other way. This was a very vile job, you know. The other men having bail so that they might walk off when they were found guilty. Aubrey alone held in prison. Of course, there was the political side, the destruction of the radicals, which was perfectly comprehensible in those whose political passions inclined them that way. But there was some hidden malice as well, and this inveteracy against your friend."
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Mrs. Barlow. "A message for Dr. Matcher and..."
"Open it, I beg," said Sir Joseph.
"Pillory," said Stephen, in a hard, cold voice. "Fine, and the pillory. Shall pay the king a fine of £2,500,
and be set in and upon the pillory opposite the Royal Exchange of the City of London for 1 hour, between the hours of 12 at noon and 2 in the afternoon.
I was afraid of it, said Blaine after a long pause, and then, tell me, Maturin, have you ever seen a man pilloried in England?
I have not.
It can be a very bloody spectacle on occasion. Oates was nearly killed. Many people are maimed, and I once saw both a man's eyes put out by pelting. Since there is an evident personal malignance here, might you not be well advised to hire a guard of bruisers? Your thief-taker would know where to find them. He would recruit them for you. I shall send to him at once. Thank you for this warning, Blaine. Now tell me, what do you think of Lady Hertford? Do you mean physically or morally or socially? As a means for preventing Jack Aubrey's name being struck off the list, Mrs. Fitzherbert advised me to apply to her. Struck off, he must necessarily be. That is the invariable rule. The real question is restoration to the list. It has been done. Even with the former seniority, when officers have been dismissed the service for duels and that kind of thing, and occasionally for harmless false musters, though it generally takes a very long time and a great deal of influence. But in a case like this, do you know the lady? Only to bow to. But I understand that at present she is all-powerful with the regent, and I'm told that Andrew Ray is well with her. It occurred to me that with a proper introduction and a proper present, I might perhaps induce her at least to start the matter moving in the royal mind. It might conceivably answer. But at present the royal mind is in Scotland, displaying the full bulk of the royal form in a little cloth petticoat to his knees, a tartan cloak, party-coloured stockings, and a Highland bonnet. And I rather fancy Lady Hertford is with him. If you like, I'll inquire and let you know. That would be kind. In the meanwhile, I shall call at Grosvenor Street on my way to the Marshalsea. You know, of course, that between an odious woman and a clever, showy coxcomb like Ray, you are likely to lose both your present and your time. Of course. Good day to you now, dear Blaine. Mr. Ray was not at home when Dr. Maturin called at Grosvenor Street, but Mrs. Ray was. She heard him give his name at the door, came running down the stairs and seized both his hands. She was ordinarily rather a plain, thick, swarthy young woman, but now she looked almost pretty. Her face glowed and her eyes sparkled with generous indignation. She had already heard the news, and she cried out, "Oh, how unjust! Oh, how wicked! The pillory for a naval officer! It's unthinkable! And he's so brave, so distinguished, so handsome! Come into my room." She led him into a little boudoir, all hung about with pictures of ships, some of them commanded by her father, but more commanded by Captain Aubrey, in the days when Babington served under him. "And so tall! He used to take such kind notice of me when I was only an awkward lump of a girl, though my father was very hard on him sometimes. Charles thinks the whole world of him, Captain Babington, I mean, and fairly worships him. And Dr. Maturin," she added in another tone and with a conscious look, "Charles values your advice most amazingly. I'm so glad. He put into the Downs last night." Then resuming, "But oh, to think of his poor wife standing there helpless while he's pelted. It's monstrous, monstrous. And the shame of it all, the hooting and the jeers must kill him, sure."
"As for that, ma'am, you're forgetting that he is innocent, which must do away with the bite of shame."
"Well, of course he's innocent. That must make a vast great difference. Not that I should have cared if he'd rigged the market 10 times over. Everybody does it. I know Mr. Ray made a great deal at the same time. But, oh, Dr. Maturin, pray sit down. Where are my wits? What would Charles think of me? Pray, take a glass of Madeira."
"Thank you, ma'am, but I must away. I'm bound for the Marshalsea itself."
"Then please give him my most respectful, no, most affectionate compliments, and to Mrs. Aubrey my best love. And if there's anything I can possibly do, children or looking after cats..."
As they came out of the boudoir, the front door opened.
Two chairmen supported Ray up the steps. Two footmen took him over with practiced hands. And as they propelled him across the hall, he turned his blotched face towards Stephen and said,
"A beaten wife and a cuckold swain have jointly cursed the marriage chain."
At the Marshalsea, Stephen found it difficult to make his way through the naval side because of the number of sailors gathered there, most of them talking at the same time and all of them exceedingly angry. Even the most gin-sodden and nearly demented still retained a very high notion of the service, and the idea of a sea officer, a post-captain, standing in the pillory was an intolerable outrage, an insult to the whole navy. Stephen was obliged to hear a petition read out and to put his name to it before he could go on. The prisoners had left the skittle ground below Jack's building empty, out of deference to his feelings, which they would scarcely have done if he'd been sentenced to be hanged. And Killick was sitting on the bottom step looking stunned, as though his world had been destroyed. As he went up the stairs, Stephen heard Jack's fiddle. It was a severe fugue played with uncommon strength and austerity, and when, having waited for the full close, Stephen tapped and opened the door, he was met with a fierce, cold glare.
"I beg pardon, Jack," he said, "I thought you said come in." "Oh!" cried Jack, his face relaxing. I'm very happy to see you, Stephen. Sit down. Sophie's just stepped out to buy some chops."
He collected himself, laid down his fiddle and bow, and turning his massive form squarely to Maturin, he said, not without a certain constraint and formality, "She told me about surprise. I'm exceedingly grateful for your offer, and I shall, of course, be delighted to command her as a private ship of war. But, Stephen, I don't quite understand. Can you indeed fit her out as well as buying her? For once I've paid my fine..."
"An iniquitous fine."
"Aye, but whining will do no good. Once I have paid my fine and my losses on the market, I shall be of no use. And fitting out a ship for even a short cruise is far, far more costly than you can imagine. Brother, I told you, I had inherited from my godfather."
"Yes, I remember you mentioned it when first we came home, but forgive me for prying into your affairs, Stephen. I'd imagined it was a little bequest for books, a mourning ring, a keepsake, the usual kind of thing from one's godfather, and very handsome too, I'm sure."
"It was, in fact, very much more than that, so very much more that we need not look attentively at each penny before we spend it. We shall carry on our private war in style." Stephen stood up to peer out of the window at the evening sky, and now, looking back into the room, he saw Jack in the full north light, sitting as though for his portrait. He seemed broader than before, heavier, profoundly grave, of course, and somewhat leonine. But beneath the unmoved gravity, Stephen perceived a wound that was hardly affected by the news of the surprise. And in the hope of easing it to some degree, he added, "And in the strictest confidence, my dear, I may tell you that our war will not be entirely private either. You know something of my activities, and at intervals of harrying the enemy's commerce, I may have errands of that kind to run." Jack took the point. He expressed his pleasure with a polite inclination of his head and the appearance of a smile, and the pain remained unaffected. Stephen continued,
"This damn spiteful pillory, brother. It's of no essential importance to an innocent man, but it is bound to be unpleasant, like a toothache. I've given you many a draught for the toothache, so I have, and here's one," taking a small bottle from his pocket, "that will make the pillory pass like little more than a dream. Disagreeable, but only faintly disagreeable, and at a distance. I've often used it myself with great effect."
"Thank you, Stephen," said Jack, setting the bottle on the mantelshelf. Stephen saw that he had no intention of taking it, and that the underlying pain was quite untouched. For to Jack Aubrey, the fact of no longer belonging to the Navy counted more than 1,000 pillories. The loss of fortune, loss of rank and loss of future. It was, in a way, a loss of being. And to those who knew him well, it gave his eyes, his whole face, the strangest look. He still had this detached, grey expression on the following Wednesday, as he stood in a bare, dirty room on the south side of Cornhill, waiting to be led out to the pillory. The sheriff's men and the constables in charge of him were all clustered together at the window. They were intensely nervous, and they kept up a continual flow of talk.
It ought to have been done days ago, right after the sentence. The news had time to go down to Land's End and up to John O'Groats. And every fucking port in the kingdom, Chatham, Sheerness, Portsmouth, Plymouth, Sweeting's alley's quite blocked up. So is Castle Alley and Moore's coming in. They ought to have sent for the soldiers long ago. We have four constables, four scavengers and one beadle in the ward. What can we do with such a crowd? If we get out of this alive, I shall take my wife and children down and live the other side of Epping. They keep pouring up from the river. There are the chaps from the press tender itself with their bloody cutlasses and bludgeons. Christ have mercy. They're blocking each side of the change with carts. God help us. Why don't he give the word? Why don't Mr. Essex give the word? They're growing outrageous down there. We shall all be scragged.
St. Paul's and the city churches had tolled 12 some 5 or 10 minutes ago, and the crowd in Cornhill was becoming impatient.
8 bells, cried some. 8 bells there. Turn the glass and strike the bell. Bring him out. Bring him out. Bring him out and let's have a look at him, shouted the leader of another group.
He was the leader of a band hired by some disappointed stock jobbers, and like his fellows, he carried a bag of stones.
Bondon turned sharp upon him and said, what are you doing here, mate? I've come to see the fun. Then just you go and see the fun at Hockley in the hole. That's where, Cully. Because why? Because this is for seamen only, do you see? Seamen only, not landsmen.
The man looked at Bondon and at the many closed, dead serious, lowering faces behind him, brown, tough, often earringed, often pigtailed. He looked at his own people, the pale and weedy crew, and with hardly a pause he said, well, I don't care about your own way, sailor. Davis, a very big, ugly, dangerous man who had sailed with Jack in many commissions, had an even shorter way of dealing with Ray's gang of genuine bruisers, who stood out most surprisingly in their flash clothes and low-crowned hats among the now almost solid naval mass. Most of the citizens, even the apprentices and the street boys hawking pails of filth, had withdrawn beyond the barrier or to neighbouring buildings. Davis, with his four uglier brothers and a dumb negro boatswain's mate, went straight to them and in a thick voice, choking with fury, said, bugger off! He watched them go and then shouldered his brutal way through his shipmates to where Stephen was standing by the steps of the pillory with the few pugilists his thief-taker had managed to engage. Men equally conspicuous. To them he said,
now you bugger off too. We mean you no harm, gents, but you bugger off too.
There was white spittle at his mouth, and he was breathing very hard. Stephen nodded to his men, and they sidled away towards St. Michael's. As they reached the church, its clock struck the quarter, and Mr. Essex gave the word at last. Jack was led out of the dark room into the strong light, and as they guided him up the steps, he could see nothing for the glare.
Your head here, sir, if you please,
said the sheriff's man in a low, nervous, conciliating voice.
And your hands just here.
The man was slowly fumbling with the bolt, hinge and staple. And as Jack stood there with his hands in the lower half-rounds, his sight cleared. He saw that the broad street was filled with silent, attentive men, some in long togs, some in shore-going rig, some in plain frocks, but all perfectly recognisable as seamen. And officers, by the dozen, by the score, midshipmen and officers. Babington was there immediately in front of the pillory, facing him with his hat off. And Pullings, Stephen, of course, Mowat, Dundas. He nodded to them with almost no change in his iron expression, and his eye moved on. Parker, Rowan, Williamson, Harvey, and men from long, long ago, men he could scarcely name. Lieutenants and commanders, putting their promotion at risk. Midshipmen and master's mates, their commissions, warrant officers, their advancement.
"The head a trifle forward, if you please, sir," murmured the sheriff's man.
And the upper half of the wooden frame came down, imprisoning his defenceless face. He heard the click of the bolt. And then, in the dead silence, a strong voice cry, "Off! Hats!" With one movement, hundreds of broad-brimmed tarpaulin-covered hats flew off, and the cheering began, the fierce, full-throated cheering he had so often heard in battle.